Tonight on Arena, we celebrate Live Aid at 40, and director of The Apprentice, Ali Abbasi, joins us ahead of his appearance at the Galway Film Fla. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The Danish-Iranian film director Ali Abbasi is the man behind one of the most controversial releases of the last year, The Apprentice, which drew the ire of, among others, Donald Trump. The film is about the relationship between Trump and lawyer Roy Cohn, a formative alliance which would in time have a profound impact on global politics. Donald Trump described the film as fake and classless, and condemned the makers as human scum. The Apprentice was Ali Abbasi's fourth feature. His work has been nominated for Academy Awards. He has competed for the Palme d'Or and directed Border, the winner of the Un Certain Regard Award at Cannes. This coming Saturday, Ali Abbasi will be in Galway to teach the Galway Film Fla's masterclass. I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Ali this evening. You're very welcome to Arena, Ali. And I'm just wondering, when you're giving a masterclass, I presume to those possibly at an early stage of their directorial career or careers, or having done a little bit and looking for, how do people like Ali Abbasi do it when they stand behind the camera? Are there a list of do's and don'ts, or where do you start with that kind of task?
Thanks for having me, and just want to say hi to you all. And that was a very juicy intro. You know, I always, when I hear the word masterclass, it's just like sort of, I get a little shiver down my spine. Like, I'm no master, and there's not going to be a master set of rules. You know, I'm not Roy Cohn, as you might have guessed. But, you know, look, this is, you know, a very sort of specific, you know, kind of activity. It's very personal. And, of course, it's also a profession, and it's also a experience curve. So what I would be doing, I would be trying to, you know, try to transfer as much of my experience as possible. And you know, I don't have any kind of, you know, superiority or any kind of like mastery to share, but I can share my experience and personal do's and don'ts, and I hope that would be helpful.
And I guess, you know, it's crass to think that there would be a set of rules, and if you follow these rules, you will automatically make a brilliant film. If it were that simple, I guess we'd all be doing it.
That's right. But you know, at the end of the day, I also think that all these kind of conversations, festivals, you know, classes, they are they're meetings. And, you know, as I've been, you know, thinking about it in my own career, you never know. You have a conversation with someone, and 5 years later, 2 months later, that could prove to be useful or not. And you know, I'm just there to sort of create the spark and hope that at some point it would ignite and inspire someone.
And I guess there is as much chance that somebody in that room will say something that might spark something within your imagination that in 4 or 5 years' time could end up making its way to the screen in some shape or form.
No, absolutely. You're absolutely right. This is a two-way street, and that's also why I'm excited to be there, because, you know, I'm not there, like I said, on a master class. I'm there on the exchange of the idea class, you know. So I'm excited, yeah.
I do wonder, however, you studied architecture. Maybe there's something in this. It's easier to come at things sometimes from an oblique angle. You studied architecture in Stockholm before you moved into filmmaking. Do you see parallels there? Have you carried something from that world, if you like, into the filmmaking world? Sometimes it's easier to see those things that seem not to be related, and in hindsight you go, of course they're totally related because of X, Y, Z.
Well, you know, I would say both architecture and cinema are studies of systems, you know, systems that are made of like small details, and you create, in order to create that whole, you have to sort of design and put together those details. So in a way, it's sort of studying the same sort of systematic thinking, but just from a different angle, different perspective. But also, it was funny because I remember when I studied in architecture, at architecture school, that's where I really figured out I'm actually interested in human beings and not the buildings. So that was maybe my detour into film.
Well, yeah, you clearly the human side of thing began to attract your attention. But you do mention systems.
It was about time.
Yeah, you do mention systems there. And my juicy intro will come into play now. Because I think in some ways in The Apprentice, that is what you were looking at. Am I right in presuming that systems, the systems that allowed somebody like Roy Cohn to do what he did, the system that allowed Donald Trump to become the businessman and the now president that he has become?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that for me is a kind of systemic thinking that, you know, sometimes you miss in American cinema that, you know, it's like, you know, Hollywood's cinematic language and the way like these movies work, they're very like individual based. Like, you know, you sort of see those sports movies and go, oh, there's this one coach that comes and like turns everything around and makes this baseball team successful and whatnot. So there's like, it's always about like individuals and like what they do and don't do. But, you know, like we have a different tradition also in Europe, which is systems, you know, the context is as important, if not more important than the individual. And it was interesting to look at it that way, you know, to the sort of whole, you know, the big, you know, this juncture in the American empire where they are trying to like formulate a new ideology, the sort of, you know, this is sort of the birth of not only Donald Trump, but the whole sort of right wing movement that he's been riding on. And I think it was exciting to sort of put these individuals in that matrix of power and see like how they align.
I mean, most people will be more than familiar with Donald Trump. People in this country may not be. And I remember when I spoke to both Sebastian Stan and Jeremy Strong at the time of the film's release, people in this country may not be as familiar with Roy Cohn as they are, obviously, with Donald Trump. Just explain, which is the story that you tell in The Apprentice, explain the formative influence Roy Cohn had on the young Donald Trump then, an estate agent, essentially, or a real estate agent.
That's right. I mean, Roy Cohn was a big deal. You know, he was a lawyer in New York, but he was really a fixer and socialite. And, you know, he knew everyone. And he also, because he started his career in being, you know, Joseph McCarthy's right-hand man, he had this sort of strange influence and you know, connections with, you know, the whole sort of right side of the spectrum with, you know, he was friends with Nixon, he was friends with a lot of these people. And he sort of used his practice as a sort of, you know, favor network. So he would do something for someone and then like another client wanted something and then he would go to the first client, get him to do a favor for the second client. So he was actually super connected, super important, and also very ruthless and also very successful and very contradictory. You know, he was sort of a homophobic, closeted gay guy. You know, he you know, there was a lot of things that maybe in the first, you know, glance didn't make sense, but he was an extremely successful sort of negotiator of power. And when he met young Donald and, you know, he got to do a case for, you know, whole Trump family, they sort of, I think Donald found the mentor that he was looking for. He also found the pupil he was looking for. And he sort of took the young Donald Trump under his wings and under his guidance, sort of, you know, Trump became the person he became then later in the 80s.
Let's listen to a clip actually from The Apprentice. And this is reasonably early on. At this stage, Roy Cohn certainly has taken Donald Trump under his wing, but he's getting him ready for, you know, how am I going to present this young man in the media? How am I going to have him handled and presented? Which, of course, Trump has become a past master, you would have to say, at how to handle the media. But here, he was a little bit more gauche and naive in the early stages, if we're to go by this clip. Young Donald Trump hasn't... hasn't got the full confidence that he has had later on in his life. And we'll hear Jeremy Strong at the top of this clip as Roy Cohn, Sebastian Stan as the young Donald Trump. And Roy Cohn is setting up an interview with a lady in the press.
Listen, Judy, about 100 reporters were crawling up my ass to get this interview, and I gave you the exclusive.
Yes, hello, Judy. This is Donald Trump. I'm very excited. Very excited to talk to you.
Be excited.
Donald, now that the lawsuit is behind you, what do you want to do next?
Well, I intend to acquire the Commodore, and I'm planning on making it the best and the finest building in the city. Maybe the country. In the world. Judy, in the world, it's going to be the finest building in the world. It's going to be a spectacular hotel. Absolutely spectacular. First class. And
that sounds very ambitious. Where do you get the drive? Still so young, Donald.
I got flair and I'm smart, so I think that's going to make me successful. But I also want to stay humble.
Sorry, Judy. Listen, let's do the rest in person and bring a photographer, okay?
Sorry, Roy.
No, I mean, listen, it's your life. You got a ways to go, but you're learning.
There we go. That was Jeremy Strong and Sebastian Stan there in a scene from The Apprentice. And joining me on the phone this evening is Ali Abbasi, the director of that particular piece. And yeah, you can hear how he has a long way to go, certainly there, Ali. But I was struck when I spoke to both Jeremy and Sebastian, as I say, at the time, they were very keen. You know, it's easy to see these two men in sort of in monstrous ways, and to see all the negative sides of their personalities. They were very keen that both men were presented as fully rounded human beings, which, of course, even the good and the bad are fully rounded
right.
human beings. How important was that aspect of things to you? Which I guess here's one for the masterclass. Don't give us goodies and baddies. Give us people.
Yeah, no, you're completely right, and this is obviously also a matter of taste, but also you know, a matter of, I would say, principles, you know, you know, I remember at the time a lot of our more liberal friends were saying, like, you know, you have to be harsher on him, and what if he wins the presidency again and whatnot, and I'm like, well, we're not making this movie for Mr. Trump. We're making this movie for ourselves. And therefore, our standard is everyone is a human being, you know, and, you know, as a human being, you have flaws, you have, you know, good things you've done. And also, we have to, when we spend this much time and energy and effort and everything, we have to give you something that you can't read, you know, on a two-page, you know, reportage or something. And that is the experience of how is it that these guys got where they got, and how is it to be these people? And I think that's what Jeremy and Sebastian did beautifully.
And it's interesting that you bring up the whole idea of ethics within your filmmaking, and that it was very important to you in the making of The Apprentice. I mean, how fictional do you think The Apprentice is? How factual do you think that it is? Because obviously your screenwriter, Gabriel Sherman, came from this journalistic background. So there really was a mix of the two things there. How did that balance play? How did those two things play off each other?
Well, you know, it is a work of fiction because, you know, we are playing with things. We're like, even if we're following, you know, reality or sort of the factual journalistic reality as closely as we can, and there are no, like, bigger contradictions, we're not, like, going out of our way to manipulate or change the narrative or whatever. But still, it's a work of fiction. So I'm, you know, at any given moment, I'm interpreting and guessing, you know, like what, you know, Mr. Trump or Roy Cohn's or everyone else's motivations were. But at the same time, this is also a movie about real people. And that was why, again, like ethically speaking, I felt, for example, compelled to invite Donald Trump to our premieres. As as funny or ridiculous or whatever as it sounds, I felt like this is a movie that he didn't choose that I made the movie. I chose to make the movie. So therefore, he should have the chance to see it. He should have a chance to comment. He should have a chance to, you know, and you know. And I would be interested if he did, like, at the time. So in that way, the standard would not change for him or anyone else, you know?
And you know, again, to go back to that introduction where you the filmmakers, not just you personally, the filmmakers were described as fake, classless and human scum. Did you get any other type of commentary from Donald Trump or from any of his people around what he did or didn't like or would like to talk to you about regarding the film? Was there any exchange of views?
I have heard from a source. And I don't know, like, I can't tell you exactly, like, you know, who that person is, but someone who's close enough, so I believe him, that, you know, Mr. Trump has seen the movie and his reaction is actually not that, you know, upset. He obviously didn't like the scene where he's raping his wife.
Which you took from Ivana Trump's, that came from her, a statement from her herself.
Yeah, and that, you know, we did our utmost to be factual and researched it, and when we felt compelled that this is, to the best of our efforts, factual, we included it. But except from that, what I've heard is he's actually not unhappy with the portrait, and, you know, that he thinks that he, like, you know, Sebastian comes across as being cool and, you know, ruthless, which is what he wants. Mm. And whereas he somehow thought that he liked Burke Cohen portrait less. And I don't know why, so I don't, you know, but that's what I heard.
Yeah, you'd need to have a full conversation with him to find out
why have to invite him on the show, yeah.
Yeah, well, the two of you are welcome at any point to hold that debate with us here in Arena. I do have to tell you that I had Tailored Films, the two producers, Ruth Tracy and Julianne Ford, on the programme with me at the time of the release
as well.
I mean, they stood with you at the time of cease and desist, to use those terrible legal terms, though that is the term that was used. Stop this movie right now, or else I'll follow you with the full rigors of the law. That was the kind of threat that was sitting over you. How difficult was it to navigate through that?
Well, look, there was the actual legal side of matter, which was, you know, I obviously consulted with people. We didn't just like went with the flow, see what happened. We consulted with people, and a bunch of legal scholars told us that, you know, Mr. Trump basically is you know, undefamable legally, you know, because of, like, you know, in like defamation, technically speaking, you have to have the intent, and there, you know, you have to really show that what you've done really changed the public perception of you know, someone, and it's exceedingly difficult for, you know, for public people, especially the kind of person, you know, Ms. Trump is, to use it. So I don't think it had legs, like, legally. But then, you know, on the other hand, you know, the 60 Minutes case that he was just settled in his favor had absolutely no legs. So, you know, this is not only about the legal stuff. But you know, I think what it did with the movie, and it's very well documented, I think it made our release exceedingly very, very difficult. And, you know, I just, like, big credit to the producers and, you know, everyone involved actually got the movie distributed to the end.
Because that did take a lot of effort. Let me move briefly to the world of television, prestige television. You directed the final few episodes, final two episodes, I think, in fact, it was, of the first season of The Last of Us, one of the biggest successes of recent years for HBO. The television climate nowadays seems so different from, you know, if you look back at whatever, 25 years ago when big film stars wouldn't touch television. Now, the two things seem to live side by side. Is it the same for you as a director? Are they much closer now than they may have been in the past?
Yeah, and, you know, these things go, like, in waves, you know, because there is a sort of market forces for in each direction, and they change. And I think there was, like, a point, you know, especially during the pandemic, where it felt like the TV factory was really at its, like, highest point. Mm-hmm. And they just wanted to make stuff. And now that sort of subsided. So it's become more normal. But, you know, and that's the sort of business side of it. As far as I'm concerned, you know, you have different formats for storytelling. None of it is better or worse because it's shorter or longer. It just depends on like what kind of storytelling and what story you want to tell. So, you know, both could be interesting, obviously.
You mentioned earlier in the interview, Ali, about we Europeans. Of course, you're of both Danish and Iranian heritage. How did that play into choosing, you know, how does that play, particularly the Iranian side of things, play into the stories that you choose to tell? Does it have an influence?
Well, you know, this is a bit tricky because obviously you don't, you know, run away or hide away from your upbringing, the cultural context you brought up and you breathed in and you experienced. But then I always question, you know, it's like, say, like if you have an Irish passport and if, you know, someone else has an Irish passport, how much of like in common sort of taste and interest and everything you two guys have, you know, based on that passport, you know? So I think that sort of nationality based thing is, it has its, you know, quite limitations. I would say I've done now movies in three or four different languages, and what I can see empirically is like, you know, when I've done a movie in Farsi, when I've done a movie in Swedish, when I've done a movie in English, they turn out to be my movies, you know, one way or the other. So, you know, that's what I can tell you.
Well, listen, you're going to have to learn a little bit of Gaeilge or Irish now when you come to Galway, because that will be another language to add to your coterie.
And look, I'm so happy to come back to Ireland. I think you guys are terrific. You're, you know, very friendly, and I also want to say that this is also an Irish movie. You know,
it
and
is
I don't want
because of Ruth and because of the two producers, as we mentioned earlier on,
and the cast as well. You know, you have some Irish actors as well.
Yes, there are Irish actors in there. That is true. Ali, lovely to have spoken with you this evening, and thanks for your time. Enjoy your trip to Galway. Brush up in your Irish and come back and talk to me when you've got your Irish language film under
Thank
your belt
you,
as well. Thanks a million, Ali. That's
bye.
Ali Abbasi speaking to us about his director's masterclass, but being very humble about how he will approach that at the Galway Film Fly. It's happening this coming Saturday. Places are still available, and you can find out full information on galwayfilmfly.com. It was a hot, sunny day, a July day, in fact, when the world turned its collective eye on Wembley Stadium. It was 40 years ago this month, the 13th of July, to be precise, that Live Aid seared its way into our hearts and our minds, raising millions for charity, cementing the legend of people such as Freddie Mercury and creating something of a saint in a man from just up the road, of course, Bob Geldof. John Maher has been writing all about Live Aid in the Independent over the in recent weeks.
I have.
and with us in studio is a young teenager. Well, he was back then, who attended Live Aid. And one of the first things that everybody heard on that day, and I will say one of the first things, you'll find out why I say that in a minute, but one of the first things they heard was this. If you ever needed proof that three chords are enough, there it is. That was Status Quo. How they opened Live Aid 40 years ago on the 13th of July. But Stephen Benedict is at great pains to point out to us that that is not the first piece of music that he, the 15-year-old boy, who I thought had kind of eloped to Wembley. It wasn't quite
with
an elopement.
Two friends, yeah. No, I mean, strictly speaking, it wasn't the first piece of music. The first piece of music was greeted with somewhat bemusement by the crowd because it was actually the national anthem, God Save the Queen.
Yeah.
And we were all going, so we're here for rock and roll. The nearest thing to royalty was this footy old fella called Prince Charles in the box up there with Princess Di and Bob Geldof.
All three of them were
they're
in the box.
They're all there on Polly.
And you as a 15-year-old, were there briefly now, please. What happened around the Benedict Christ dinner table one evening?
Yeah, well, I had asked a couple of weeks earlier, could I go to see Bruce Springsteen? My parents said, no way. I mean, I grew up in a household where there was more Beethoven and Bruckner in the house than Bowie and the Boomtown Rats. And then when my parents heard about the riot the previous year in Slane with Bob Dylan, they said, there's no way you're going to ever go into a rock concert. My friend Alan Murphy said, Stephen, I've got tickets. Do you want to go? And I said, so I sat down and I wrote literally an essay to my mum and dad as a pitch. And then I said to myself, I rehearsed it and I said to myself, when am I going to say it? Will I get them alone in the living room? Will I ask to see them? La, 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 la. And then at dinner, suddenly dad says, what's this about Live Aid? And I was tongue-tied and I tried to explain, you know, la, 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 Alan's got tickets. And dad says, are you going? And I went, I don't know. What happened was Alan's parent, Paddy and Finola, had phoned my mum and dad and greased the rails. So that's the reason why I was able to go to
John, London. Your parents would not allow the 10-year-old John Markle.
No, the 10-year-old was in the Midlands watching the entire event with my mother. And
until 4 a.m. the following morning?
Well, certainly up to midnight. I think at that point, Philadelphia had really taken over. I used to, there was a steady diet on Thursday nights of Top of the Pops with her. And I mean, we had just, the two of us had played the Band-Aid song over to such a degree my father wanted to throw the record player out of the house, but it was such a lucid memory.
Yeah, well, I mean, that Band-Aid record from the previous Christmas, wasn't it? That is so vital to how Live Aid even came to pass.
Oh, very much so. It's like, it's quite extraordinary.
Feed the World, obviously, I'm speaking about.
Do they know it's Christmas in terms of being the biggest selling single of the 1980s in Britain? But it's remarkable, just to go back to October 1984, and Bob Geldof watches that famous Michael Burke report for the BBC, and then that night goes to a book launch from Peter York, who chronicled the kind of the posh folks of London of the 1980s, the Sloan Rangers. Mm. And he was just, that rage was within him, and he wanted to do something. Of course, to be blunt, the Boomtown Rats had really ground to a halt. So there was a sense of a man here looking for something, and he found it.
I mean, when we think of it now, it is hard to separate the politics from the rock and roll. But was there any sense in Wembley on that day, Stephen, of the politics around it? Or was it just, give me the next rock? Because, I mean, it really was... You know, the top billing of everybody in the world kind of were there. And if they weren't there, they were going to be in the US later on in the evening.
It came in flashes, you know.
The politics did.
Yeah, I think, well, if I can just contextualize it for a second, we've got to remember Ireland back in the 1980s, a backwater, known internationally as a place of drunks, priests and terrorists. And so whenever I went to England, my mum and dad always told me to keep a mouth shut in public. And so that was the warning that when I was going to London with these four reprobate older friends, I mean, they were 17 and 18 and I was 15. So mum and dad said, keep your mouth shut. So when you two came on and somebody up front started waving an Irish flag, I was half expecting the Metropolitan Police to come in and tear it down. I'm not kidding. And there was a seismic shift in my sense of what Irishness meant in that moment, because then it was all of a sudden, well, Bob is Irish. And there are U2 on stage, and it's not so bad. But the big one was when Bowie came off early in his set and played only four songs instead of five. And I'm going to get really upset now because he showed that video of all the starving children in Ethiopia.
Yeah, you couldn't avoid that one. Yeah,
this was to remind everybody the reason why we're here. And there, I mean, we can easily get very, very maudlin. But the thing about the whole day and the whole thing was it was incredibly sincere. And there's a connectivity that everybody had about that day. And so
I think
it was
everybody
just
knows where they were or where they were watching it and what they were doing for most of that day.
Well, it was incredibly seismic. Nothing of this scale had ever been attempted before. And of course, it was harnessing technology as it was at the time to have these two shows happening.
We're not quite at the first telethon, but we can't be that far off. It's a very early version of the telethon that was happening here in RTE.
Well, the funny thing was the last act in London was Paul McCartney, and Paul McCartney himself had taken part in the very, very first satellite live broadcast, which was the Beatles singing All You Need Is Love. That was the first one. So it was a beautiful tie-in. I don't know whether Bob Geldof knew that. I mean, surely he would have, but the thing was, Well, Paul McCartney was the biggest act that day in terms of sales.
For sure. I mean, from an Irish point of view, the Telethon was Tony Boland, late of this station. You know, he worked here for many years, still very much with us in his 80s. But he had seen telethons in the US and thought, let's do that here. In fact, it was him who gave Geldof the idea to have telethons, not to sell the rights to the European Broadcast Union, but to actually get each kind of TV network around the world to pay the BBC much more than they would have had to pay the EBU. So already thinking of, let's generate as much income as possible.
Let's have a listen to how one very fine actor introduced one very fine Irish band.
And now, deep with the international and global feeling that we have, a group... What? Direct from London, Bill tells me, a group whose heart is in Dublin, Ireland, whose spirit is with the world, a group that's never had any problem saying how they feel, you too.
He was so right, Jack Nicholson, to correct whoever was nudging from the side, direct from London. No, whose heart is in Dublin, Ireland.
Yeah.
You must remember that moment, Stephen.
Yeah, well, very clearly, because, I mean, the thing was, we've got to remember that U2 weren't U2 at that stage. They were the Irish band U2. They had to be given this sort of little bit of an introduction. And, you know, it was great, as I was saying, to when they started flying the flag. But then something extraordinary happened, I think, that everybody remembers, is that Bono went on Walkabout. And for us in the audience, we were not impressed at all, because everybody in that stadium had gone to sing the songs of their favorite artists and belt along with them. And then all of a sudden he disappeared. And it had a completely different effect on, I think, for audiences at home. Because what Bono, unintentionally or not, what he did was he made a connection between, he broke the barrier between the stage and the audience. And that, I think, had a huge effect on audiences.
How
back
did he
home.
Do when you say he broke the barrier? What
he
do you mean?
Jumped off the stage and went into the moat and had a young girl dragged out of the crowd because he thought she was in difficulty. And there was all of a sudden there was a connectivity between that. And that's really what the whole day was about, this transatlantic satellite global thing.
Yeah, but then let's talk politics. What did they sing? And it's, for the most part, it's the crowd who are singing Sunday, Bloody Sunday. John Maher and Stephen Bendick with me in studio this evening. We're remembering Live Aid 40 years ago on the 13th of July, 1985. What a ballsy thing to do. You know, this is a young Irish band, John Maher, who stand up and sing this song, Sunday, Bloody Sunday. And Stephen mentioning earlier on that he had seen the lone
tricolour
up at the front of the Wembley crowd. That was quite the moment.
Yeah, it really was. It took a lot of nerve from Bono, but I suppose there was a sense, you know, I mean, his sincerity about, you know, famine relief has always been there. Nobody can deny that. But also, he was aware we have 1.5 billion people watching us. Here is an opportunity to do something extraordinary. So not just jumping into the crowd, but also playing a song like that, as anthemic and strident as it is, and how rapturously it was received by that crowd. And I mean, back home, the 10-year-old Irish kid was incredibly proud of the Irish band doing this.
But because he went on Walkabout, they had to drop their third song, which was Pride in the Name of Love, which was going to have a huge connection with America.
Yeah, and the other members of the band were furious.
They were ready to, apparently, legend has it that they were ready to boot him out. Yeah, but another thing was that struck me about U2's position was that they were put on at 5 o'clock. And Geldof would have been very, very careful in how he structured the afternoon and who was going to be on before who. And 5 o'clock meant 12 o'clock in Philadelphia, and which means that the Americans were tuning in just at that moment. Yeah. And this was the first act for them to see from London. So it was a very, very big opportunity that he was giving them.
Yeah, and what would the relationship have been like between the Boomtown Rats and U2 at that stage? U2 hadn't quite... Boomtown Rats had kind of faded away, you were saying?
Oh, very much so. They really had. And U2 had done very well with War, you know, and... Unforgettable Fire was, you know, 1985. Yeah. So there was a sense of an upward momentum. Mm. But for Geldof, and he's quite open about this. I mean, so I've interviewed him a number of times, and he said by the turn of 84, the band were on the essentially gone. Yeah. You know, that nobody cared. I mean, like, you know, they were very much a punk band, and punk had had its moment. Post-punk and New Romantics and pure pop and all kinds of Duran was taking over, you know?
I know. If you two spoke very loudly to us at home and if Status Quo got everybody rocking all over the world as the opening song, how can we ever ignore the input of this man and this band? Ah, yes, the late, great Freddie Mercury. And both John Mayer and Stephen Benedict, they have the 10-year-old John Mayer and the 15-year-old Stephen Benedict, remembering, well, I don't know if you knew it at the time, Stephen, this the Queen appearance at Wembley, they weren't keen and Bob Geldof wasn't keen.
No, I mean, we wouldn't have known that in the audience. But the thing was, when the second he came out and he did this day...
Don't be doing it. No, I'll let him do it.
Sorry. Seventh. But the thing was, again, it's a connectivity. 72,000 people, yeah, unprompted, responded to that. And the way he held us in the palm of his hand for the next 15 minutes was...
All right. Well, sorry. Let's listen. No. Properly. How are you to know? How are you to know? Here is what Stephen Benedict was trying to do. I could hear you in the crowd, Stephen Benedict. Your deo is unmistakable now that we've heard it live on air and live from Wembley from 40 years ago. You were saying, John, about that sounds so spontaneous.
Well, they had rehearsed this 20-minute set for days beforehand, ruthlessly rehearsing this, because a lot of the bands, you know, a lot of the acts that played both Philly and London, it was very spontaneous and it sounded spontaneous, whereas this was ruthlessly performed and rehearsed. And it was the second coming to a degree. You know, Stephen mentions Slane. I mean, the following year, 86, it's Queen who are headlining. So yeah. Henry Mountcharles is looking at this thinking, absolutely want this band play in my backyard.
It's gone clean out of my head, the question that I was going to ask him about.
You were hopefully going to ask me about Sade.
I was, but not until the end of the item.
Okay. I'm ruining the sequence of the show, sorry.
It's supposed to be spontaneous and unrehearsed, Stephen. Don't you understand? Yes, I know what I did want to ask. The money is what it all boils down to here. And once again, John, I think you've looked into to this side of things. The specifics of how much money was raised in this country, it's quite extraordinary.
It's absolutely extraordinary. By the end of the day, well over £1 million Irish pounds had been raised, which was 10 times per annum what was raised across the Irish Sea. And Geldof, who by his own admission isn't the most patriotic of people, said that he was incredibly proud to be Irish. And by kind of September 85, £7.5 million had been raised in Ireland alone. The government, the Fine Gael Labour coalition, had put in 250,000 of that, or internationally across the 150 countries that watched it, £150 million was raised. So, you know, it was comfortably the biggest charitable kind of event, not just rock concert, but event in history up to that point.
All right. And now, Stephen, it is time. Did you have a favourite act before you fell asleep and Phil Collins?
Queen, I was just completely rhapsodised by how incredible it was. in a bohemian kind of way.
Oh, lordy. Okay. Stephen.
Yeah, well, my favourite act was David Bowie, and I will say that I thought Queen were okay, but Freddie was the person who made it.
Queen were okay.
Yeah, but it was Freddie. It was Freddie who did the whole thing. Yeah, I mean, he came out and was an incredible showman. I have to say, though, David Bowie had incredible nerves of steel
but
come out.
You're setting up Sade now, not David Bowie.
Well, yeah, to set that up, we've got to remember it was an incredibly hot day. It was about 85 degrees. I checked the weather the other day. It was 85 degrees, but in the stadium, it would have been about 90. Water was at a premium that afternoon. It was really ironic that we weren't being... Yeah. We had to bring our own. And Sade came on at about 3 o'clock. She played this beautifully cool, mellow jazz soul set. And as always, she designed her own costume. You can remember Shadi with her sleek back hair and a gold hoop earrings and a Paloma Picasso lipstick. And she's wearing this bolero jacket, white halter top. Music is playing. Your Love is King. The saxophone solo starts. She turned her back on the audience, let her bolero jacket slip off to reveal a deep plunging backline, and the guy in front of me keeled over and collapsed.
There you go.
So that is the effect that Shadi.
15-year-old Stephen Bendick, 10-year-old John Maher, off home to your beds now. And none of your eloping to Wembley, Stephen Bendick. Here is Shadi. Your love is king. Your love is king there from Shadi. And just one final detail that I did want you to say about Shadi, because it is important. You were speaking to John about Stephen during that song.
She was the only black artist to play in London. America was a very, very different matter, but Shadi was the only black artist on the London bill.
And worth mentioning that for sure. Stephen Bendick, not still 15, and John Maher, a little bit older than 10. Thank you both for coming into us this evening and remembering Live Aid 40 years on. Now, although the autumn season traditionally dominates Irish publishing, 2025 has offered already a rich crop of Irish language books, from memoir, political history, to playful satire, revitalised classics and poetry. Writer Ilish Nikolivna highlights the books that have stood out for her, not only for their literary merit, but for what they reveal about language, memory, justice and imagination. Fairvich as to chocht ling an ocht or be ves chocht the studio ling an ocht Ilish. Ken size cooked a thaw egg lower or square again? We law her.
Ken size cooked the thaw egg. Well, Sheedham over excreefu her Dun Irish Times, Shakton O'Dohin, Dun Alsho of Ian, Gwil Elon Lower. An a vache fad an, ach jerhing gemrahen an coacht an publiacht a einschied.
An
leirhor. Agus an nuchton nu an radio nu peirod. So, countess na faibane agus bien na scrivnori gailga agus eintas na scrivnori the Irish Writers Union a gyrán fwi na nach mien glor leirvasane ins na man Berle. So it is Irish language books are reviewed quite there's good coverage in the Irish language media in on Radio na Gaeltachta on Core magazines like Core and Tourish.ie and that sort of thing. But they would like to have a bit more coverage in the English language media. It's complicated.
Of course it is, because part of the issue is, I like to use the cúpla focal, and even if it's only a sentence or kesh the wán, that's great. At least it's out there. But not everybody can understand everything you're saying.
That's a gahuntuk, Sean. I mean, úsáidin tú gaelga anafinig.
Well, let's rachamich an ishgadi learn ivar a hain. First book that you're going to speak about, Ronan Machanomara on Gluishat Skil Charta Shivilta na Gaeltachta. So we're talking about Ronan Machanomara here. Background in both journalism and broadcasting,
yes.
And what he's writing about here, both of those strands fit perfectly into the themes of this book.
Absolutely. So this is a very readable and entertaining history of the Gluaiseacht Chearta Sibhialta na Gaeltacht, the Gaeltacht civil rights movement. And, I thought when I opened it, oh my gosh, is it possible, not to be boring during the history of civil rights
title,
movement or
as
political
a title,
movement
it doesn't
or
sound,
whatever.
It doesn't sound promising necessarily.
But it is obviously very important as a work of history and a reference work to this movement, which was crucial in obtaining rights and improving the status of Irish in the Gaeltacht and even throughout the country. But he it's a very readable book. He manages to do it. Oh, he is a journalist and he's used to making things accessible and so on. But I think he writes it almost as if it were, in some parts anyway, as if it were a novel. He opens with this. I mean, it all started as a protest against Telefiche Éireann, RTE, who in 1967 went to Teach Furbo in Connemara to do an issue of Quicksilver. You don't remember Quicksilver because you weren't even born then.
Stop the Lights, you do, of course.
Do you? Stop the Lights. Bunny Carr. And it was kind of, it seemed to be a kind of celebrity version of it because it was the day after St. Patrick's Day. Mm. And it was all Asperla. So
there was no Stad na Sailte.
There was no Stad na Sailte. So, but outside they were Stad na Sailte, and the movement seemed to grow out of that. So, I mean, he opens with this kind of interesting, funny, but significant and dramatic episode, and so on. There's he tells a wonderful, a really nice telling story about Joe Steve O'Nocton, who became, you know, an actor and a writer and was a member of Ace Donna, died maybe a year or two ago. Joe Steve, quite important in the, in, you know, Irish culture and drama and television and everything. In 1969, he was 25. He was going to go to England to work on the buildings. Mm. And somebody said to him, Joe, came fogan enha ishin, you go to England, come home at Christmas, agus thresh couple punta, you'd be shouting up the Republic. And he said, stay here and do something about the Hig Fein, which is what happened,
Okay, Ronan McNamara on Gluishuk, the movement, Skeel Charta Shavelta and the Gaeltacht, the civil rights movement in the Gaeltacht. Chloe or Connacht, that's who we're talking about in most of the cases.
Yes.
And I want to move along with them because I want to get to as many of them as we possibly can, Eilish. Sonia Le Padar O'Molla. Is this fiction? Are we in a Gairscale?
No. This is a memoir.
A memoir.
Yeah. And it's a memoir about child abuse. When Padar was nine in 1960, a teacher molested him over in the course of a year in school behind a blackboard or a board or something in the classroom. Just unbelievable. And so that is really the basis of the memoir. He's talking about this experience.
How harrowing a read is that? How harrowing a read? How difficult a read is it?
It's quite harrowing, actually, when he's describing that episode and the part of it. But he kind of contextualizes it in, you know, in the times and in the way people were. He had, and there's some almost positives. An interesting thing, this happens in the case, in a lot of these cases, seems to be in all of them, he didn't tell anybody. He had very kind and loving parents, and they were kind of just living beside the school, but he never told told them. But he goes on to write about the impact it had on his entire life, you know, because this is a long time ago. And he also writes about, you know, the broader picture of the abuse of children in Irish institutions, etc.
Sonaha.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's move on to Joe McHugh. Title here. Beg to all right. Er the Bicycle. No, Er the Bicycle is not there. An Irish Language Journey, published by Red Stripe. Joe McHugh, Minister for the Gaeltacht in 2014.
Well, this book is actually in English, but he includes a lot of Irish and a lot of his favourite phrases and comments on place names and so on. So, there were protesters here outside the Dáil in 2014 shouting, Joe McHugh, Eric Conclue. And he said he didn't know Irish. He's from Carrigart. Mm. His mother is from Glenvar, where my father is from. that is a brack ailtocht. But anyway, fuck me chin marahoshe. But he learned Irish. He went to Glencolum Kill, and it's about his journey, and he's encouraging other people to kind of do the same.
Duchon Blurry o Oclor Vorchino Kine. This is from the Royal Irish Academy, edited by Charles Dillon and Colm O'Cuig. A dictionary of a kind? How would you describe it, Eilish?
It's more like, what would you call it? It's a collection of phrases and shanuckle and words emanating, selected from the million words which Mortín O'Kine wrote down for the Dictionary of Irish, the Gaeilge Gabhairle Dictionary, which finally was published in 1977. O'Kine worked on it like a lot of people. I mean, you're always meeting Irish language writers who worked on folklore. Yeah. They were on folklore. So
a similar number to the people who were in the GPO in 1916, was it? something like that?
I don't think it's like that. Yes, I think they really were there. But anyway, I'd say he was one of the most prolific of the people who worked on it, and you can see how it influenced the book. It's a book for dipping into for the for the ordinary reader. It'll be of great scholarly interest to people who are studying Mortín O'Kine, and it's gorgeous. It's kind of a lavish production with these wonderful, I hesitate to call them illustrations, works of art by Sean O'Flaherty.
I want to talk about two final things before we go. First of all, Donta Idirshan agus nua Áineann Glynn.
Yes.
New and old, new and selected, or new and old poems. Yeah.
Well, Áine, as you know, is a super, she's very well known as a writer of children's books. She was Laureate Nanoag a couple of years ago, but she's also a really important poet. So there has been a previous selected, but this selected is wonderful, and it comes with great translations by Theo Dorgan.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. We'll be speaking to Theo later in the week about his new novel, I do believe. Finally, give me a couple of the picture books that you had chosen, if you would, Eilish. Some of them for Léir Hóirí Óga and some of them for Léir Hóirí Éasta, I guess.
Well, maybe the very Éasta people might remember Bourchin by Brídni Lánchig, which was first published in 1953, and there's a new version of that edited by Muireann Ní Mhóireáin with lovely illustrations. Another one about a chicken is Kitty Clark by Patricia Ford, also with nice illustrations, which is a reissue of Fota Fáta's 20th. Fota Fáta has been around the publisher for 20 years, and one of their first books, picture books, was Kitty Clark. But I would like to mention Baudelaire by Dark O'Scully, because I love that novel so much, and I would really recommend people to read it.
Okay, well, why wouldn't you say it then as well? Gurumil Maha Gutharish, Eilish, Eilish Nguyen, and Shin. August Lauer Oscuiliga, Avishay Grofwi, and Shin, Arag Lauerchwi. Shin and Majatha Agamsa, and Nocht K. V. Egoberlum. So on sound supervision, on Tussle, Tommy O'Sullivan, our broadcast coordinator, Ollie Hamilton, Leah Murphy, and Paula Shields researched. Reg Luby was the producer this evening, and I will be back with you once again tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.